Welcome. This is Joe Aguirre once again in studio with the same scholar team, Jeff Swearing, Fuzz Rana, Kenneth Samples, and Hugh Ross. On this recording, we will address the difficulties that RTB has with theistic evolution. And Fuzz, let's start with you. What do you see as some of the scientific difficulties that you have with theistic evolution?
Well, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, at one point in time, I was a theistic evolutionist. After I came to faith in Christ, I was thoroughly convinced that the original life had to require the involvement of a creator. And I was convinced that the structure of biochemical systems revealed the work of a designer. But from that point on, I felt like the rest of life's history could be explained through an evolutionary process. And so I was a theistic evolutionist. And I would even argue that that included the evolution of human beings. And it was a number of years after being a Christian that I won't get into the details here, became interested in what really is the evidence in favor of biological evolution. Because one thing that happens when you are trained as a biochemist is that you're not really presented with a thorough case for evolution. Rather, you are exposed to elementary arguments that are presented in biology textbooks and then just simply assumed to be true. And everything you do then is interpreted from within that framework. And most of what I did as a researcher in biochemistry did not require me even to think about things in evolutionary terms. I was simply looking at the structure and the function of cell membranes. So I held to that position without really giving it a whole lot of thought that God used evolution to create, because, of course, this is what science says, that there's overwhelming evidence for it.
Now, Fuzz, what you see in biology is they will identify mechanisms for biological evolution. But would you agree that it's seldom that the biologist actually looks at those mechanisms and tests whether or not they can produce the claimed results in the environment and the time that's available?
That's probably true. But you have to keep in mind, too, that there is evidence that people can cite where you have, I think, robust evidence for biological evolution. Now, this is at the level of adaptation or variation within a species or speciation. And so, for example, things like the peppered moth changing its wing color, that's fairly compelling evidence for evolution happening within a fairly short period of time, where natural selection looks like it's at work. Or the Galapagos finches, which look like it was a radiation event where a finch species made its way to the Galapagos.
And to be fair, isn't this a fact that everybody across the creation evolution spectrum would agree on?
Exactly.
Including young Earth creation.
Exactly. Or as a biochemist, you're constantly presented evidence for viruses evolving resistance to antiviral materials or being able to evolve to escape the host's immune system, as the case of the HIV virus, or bacteria evolving resistance to antibiotics. These are classic systems that all biologists are working with. And so there is evidence for evolution, but this is evolution happening at the micro level, if you will. As a biochemist, I never was exposed to, much with respect to going on in the fossil record, that type of thing. I just simply assumed that these scientists who are working in this have the evidence at hand. I'm not aware of it because I'm not digging into the details. But if I did, I'm sure I would find an abundance of evidence for it. And I was aware of these evidences for microevolution. So, of course, evolution is a fact. It was really about, about 10 years after I came to faith in Christ, which was very early on as a graduate student, that I became convinced that there was really a dearth of evidence for the evolutionary paradigm. And for the first time, I began to ask the questions, what really is the evidence for this? And again, I was pretty much convinced that the origin of life lacked that any kind of evidence. And that's a place where, as a chemist, I was able to look at the mechanisms that were being proposed and be able to evaluate them robustly and say there's no way that chemistry and physics is going to generate the elegance of biochemical systems. But as I began to think more critically about the evidence for biological evolution, in fact, began to just demand to see what that evidence was and began to search it out myself, I realized that there's a whole host of problems that go beyond the origin of life. The fossil record does not look like you'd expect it to look if evolution was the only game in town. Every time there's biological innovation, it happens explosively with the origin of life, the origin of bacteria and archaea, the origin of eukaryotic organisms. This is called the eukaryotic Big Bang, the origin of animals. Throughout the history of animals on Earth, you see radiation events where there's explosive diversification of animal forms. According to the evolutionary paradigm, evolution should not repeat itself. Yet we see time and time again mounting evidence where it looks as if indeed evolution would have had to have repeated itself. That to me is an inconsistency in the evolutionary paradigm. So those are some reasons why I now am troubled by the evolutionary framework, and why I think a better model to understand the history of life on Earth is one where God is intervening, where you do have microevolution at work, but God is intervening to bring about creative purposes. So I'm highly skeptical of the idea of the evolutionary mechanism having genuine creative potential.
All right. Ken, I'll pose the same question to you. Difficulties with theistic evolution?
Well, I think the way I would approach the question, Joe, is I would want to raise biblical and theological, first of all, observations,
okay. But
then concerns and criticisms of theistic evolution. The observation I would make, and this is somewhat underscoring what Hugh said in an earlier segment, and that is that this is a new position, not without some roots in Christian history, particularly since Darwin. But there isn't one prominent systematic theological expression of theistic evolution. And the problem there is wanting to be a fair critic, wanting to be careful in my criticism, I might criticize Howard Van Til's version, but somebody else may come across and say, but I don't hold that distinctive point of view. So it's hard to pin down the official position. I think that's an important qualification. But let me just say, I think there are at least six difficulties or challenges when it comes to the Bible and theology about theistic evolution. I'm simply going to enumerate them and simply explain them. Number one, I think, is the issue of the genre of Genesis. The issue is that theistic evolutionists often, if not exclusively, want to change the genre of Genesis from a historical narrative to a semi-mythical. But the problem is that Genesis 1 and 2 don't easily conform to allegory or pure poetry. Number two, God's providential intervention. The issue here is it seems that theistic evolution severely limits God's providential intervention into the cosmos. And so what you have is God intervening from the transcendent to the immanent. Much of Christian theology has said that God numerously, constantly intervening from the outside to the inside, from the transcendent to the immanent. This idea of front-loading creation then limits that particular intervention. Third, there are exegetical issues, specifically with regard to Genesis, but in other places. But for example, Genesis 2:7 that talks about the creation of Adam. Can you say that God is moving from the inanimate to the animate? That is, does he take the inanimate dust to the ground and then produce life? But if I hold a theistic evolutionary viewpoint or an evolutionary creation viewpoint, depending on the terms you use, it seems I have to move from the animate to the animate. I don't move from the dust to the ground. I move from some species that is alive to another species, more complex species that is alive. That's difficult to get all of that out of the text or to make that work. Number four, and this is a very important issue. This might be the most critical issue. How about the historicity of Adam and Eve? All of the theistic evolutionists that I've spoken with personally, and I've fortunately been able to talk to some very thoughtful and reflective theistic evolutionists, all of them deny that Adam was the first man, and many, if not most of them, deny that Adam was a historical person. Now, I have to qualify that. There are some who say Adam was a historical person, but I would think that they would orient that or explain that a little differently than we would here at Reasons to Believe. So here are the implications of that. Did Jesus and the New Testament authors believe in a historical Adam? Was there an end time and space fall? What is my connection as a sinner to where did I get my sinful nature from? When Paul compares in Romans 5 Adam and Jesus, this is a critical question. And of course, it lays out the question, if there isn't a historical Adam, then aren't you reinterpreting historic Christianity? And that's where I get very interested. That's where my interest really peaks. But two other points. A further implication, so point number five, would be the creator-redeemer relationship. It seems that theistic evolution could have creation and providence move on a purely naturalistic basis, but then the redeemer element kind of comes out of left field. Whereas in the more traditional perspective, God is intervening, constantly caring for his creation, and the emergence of the Messiah, there is less of a break there. And so I raise that question about the creation providence elements relating to the Redeemer. And then lastly, and this is the overarching issue, what about challenges to biblical inerrancy? I mean, if you say that the Bible accommodates pre-scientific truths, what does that say about the truth of God's word? So was the Bible only true in the ancient world, but it's no longer true, technically true today? I think those are at least 6 points that are very critical to discuss.
Very good. Okay. Jeff, you got any further scientific challenges?
I have a couple, and one's kind of a theological / scientific challenge, then another is something that is more scientifically related. And it kind of goes to the concept of if God is using only the laws of physics, that in essence, you know, God, whether he starts life here on Earth and it just kind of evolves the way it is, if life just grows, then there's a question of how unique or special is humanity. I mean, I think one thing that's very important is while physically we're nothing special, that we are a prominent feature of creation. And, you know, we're increasingly aware that the universe is far larger than anything we could see. And the implication of that is that there may very well be stuff out there that's similar to the Earth. If you get to far enough reaches away. And so there, if humanity just arises as a natural consequence of the laws of physics, there are other humans out there. And that poses issues for the atonement and the incarnation and all these other things that I think are difficult theological issues that just naturally arise if humanity is just kind of a natural consequence of God front-loading creation. On another aspect of, and this is more scientifically related, is my understanding is, you know, that, or the way I've always heard the theory of evolution kind of put forth is that, you know, you've got all these changes in the environment and then organisms are just kind of responding to these changes in environments. And, you know, the Earth is kind of more or less constant. Well, as we look through the history of Earth, what we see is two things that I think pose challenges to the traditional way the evolutionary framework has been put forth, is that first, there are phenomenal changes that have occurred on Earth since Earth was first came into being. Atmosphere has dramatically changed, the amount of continents, all sorts of things have changed that are, you kind of wonder how could the various kinds of life even have accommodated that scale of change. But even more critically, that what we see today is there is this that the organisms actually play, the life here on Earth plays a vital role in how Earth changes. It changes the atmosphere. It changes the way the continents look and erode. It changes, why we have rain. Bacteria play a large part in why we have rain. And so rather than organism, you know, the Earth kind of being the system that organisms live in and respond to, we see this kind of symbiotic cycle of organisms affecting the environment, and the environment changing in such a way that produce more and more complex, or that can accommodate more and more complex organisms. So it looks more like a machine that is operating well together, rather than life just kind of responding to this physical Earth. And so how that works in an evolutionary framework, I think, is a little more problematic to describe and account for.
Okay. Hugh, I'll pose a question to you as well.
Okay,
well,
let me start with a theological issue. And I would see a failure to really appreciate the strength of the evidence for a constructive integrationist model, in the sense that Genesis is not the only place in the Bible that deals with creation. I mean, they're making the proposition that, there isn't all this scientific detail in Genesis that we should worry about. It's an allegory. It's kind of a poetic thing. It's a polemic against the Near Eastern myths. But as you go throughout the rest of the 66 books of the Bible, you'll encounter many more creation texts. And keep in mind, there's far more creation content outside the book of Genesis than there is inside the book of Genesis. The book of Job contains more than the entire book of Genesis when it comes to creation content. You also have a lot in the Psalms. There's about half a dozen creation Psalms that we see. You've got Proverbs, you've got Isaiah, you've got Romans, you've got Revelation. And when you look at those other creation texts, it's very difficult to draw the conclusion that the Bible is not addressing the scientific details of the history of the universe and of life. And so if you really want to be consistent with the whole of the Bible, I think it really does argue that not only does Job and Proverbs and Psalms and Isaiah, etc., give us specific creation details and creation chronology, but Genesis does as well. Moreover, that you can successfully integrate them in a non-contradictory fashion. As we've often said, it's not enough to take the Bible literally. We have to take it literally and consistently. And I would also argue, I agree with Ken, that biblical inerrancy is at stake. The Bible not only is faithful and trustworthy and inerrant with respect to faith and practice, but also history, geography, and science. And if you're going to claim that it's only faith and practice, then you're kind of leaving it up to the human interpreter to figure out where the faith and practice lie and where geography, science, and history lie. And it's easy to fall into a very liberal interpretation of Scripture where you now begin not to even trust it in terms of faith and of practice. So that would be my theological critique that I would add to Ken's critiques, which I thought were very valid. Just to pick up on some of the things that Jeff was saying, is that theistic evolution seems to be driven by people in the biological sciences. And there again, there's a need for constructive integration. So when it comes to interpreting the history of life on planet Earth, biology and paleontology are not enough. You also have to take into account mathematics, physics, astronomy, geology, anthropology, all these sciences, genetics, all have to be taken into account in order to get a consistent interpretation of the history of life on planet Earth. Jeff made mention of the fact that the chemistry of the atmosphere changes. The Earth begins with huge oxygen sinks, and those oxygen sinks have to be filled before it's possible to bring advanced large-bodied life on the face of the Earth. And the thing that we notice is every time the oxygen content goes up, we see an immediate response in terms of new forms of life that can take advantage of that oxygen. It's not a slow, gradual process. It happens right away. A failure to appreciate the changing physics of the sun. The sun begins by getting dimmer as it loses mass early in its history for the first billion or billion and a half years. Then it stops losing significant mass, and at that point we see a change in the history of the sun where now it becomes progressively brighter and brighter as it continues to convert hydrogen to helium in its core. Where today the sun is about 15% brighter than it was when God first created life 3.8 billion years ago. The Earth's rotation rate has slowed down by about 4 to 6 times since God created the first life form. The moon is farther away, which means that the tidal interaction is different. The radiation coming from the interior Earth has changed. And then overlapping all this are severe astronomical catastrophes striking the Earth, where you got asteroids and comets of large size striking the Earth, supernova exploding, gamma ray bursts. You have snowball events taking place. And we actually see this being addressed in Psalm 104. It's a property of all life to die off, but God recreates and renews the face of the Earth. And so I think as you integrate across all the sciences, you have an answer to Ken Miller's objection. You know, if you take our model seriously, then that means that God is removing life at frequent episodes and replacing that life in a wholesale fashion. That's not evidence, in our opinion, for a bumbling God that doesn't know what he's doing, has to create by trial and error. What he's doing is he's removing life from the planet that's no longer appropriate for the changed physics of the solar system and replacing with new life, quite different life, that is now ideally designed to deal with the changing chemistry and physics of the solar system. And it's in such a way that we can see that throughout the past 3.8 billion years, Earth has always maintained the maximum biomass and the maximum biodiversity in the context of the physics and the chemistry of the surface of the Earth that exists at that time. And as Jeff pointed out, the life that God creates plays a critical role in compensating for all the changed physics. So, for example, as the sun gets brighter and brighter, God creates life or removes life from the planet and replaces it with new life that's more efficient at pulling greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere, more efficient in working with the plate tectonics and the erosion forces so that more greenhouse gases are pulled out of the atmosphere. So as the sun is getting brighter and brighter, God uses the life that he creates to pull sufficient greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere that the temperature of the surface of the Earth remains a constant. I mean, if you look at the plants that God creates, we see that over the history of the Earth, those plants are progressively more and more efficient at eroding the continental land masses. And it's through that erosion that carbon dioxide gets converted into sand and carbonates, pulls greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere, but at the same time produces needed biodeposits for future human civilization. That's another factor I don't think is taken into account. Global high-technology human civilization requires a rich, diverse treasure chest in the crust of the Earth of biodeposits. The city of Los Angeles that we live in, 99% of what you see in terms of the steel, the metals, the concrete, are biodeposits. And of course, we use biodeposits as energy sources to fuel our civilization. And finally, Joe, we need to appreciate that the physics and the astronomy of the universe and the solar system provide an extremely narrow time window for human civilization to exist, at most a few tens of thousands of years wide. How do you explain, if God is only working through the gradual processes behind the scene, why these different life forms always appear at exactly the right time? We human beings appear at exactly the right time. We don't miss the time window. Everything happens in perfect sequence with perfect timing, with perfect diversity and perfect biomass and perfect selection of just the right species at just the right time, which means there must be a mind behind the whole thing that's actively, supernaturally intervening to make sure everything's just right so when humans come upon the scene, they can fulfill their divine purpose in working with God to bring about the end of all evil and suffering and ushering us into a brand new creation. That would be a final comment I would make, is that to really deal with these issues of the history of life on planet Earth, we have to look at it in the larger context of how God is using the present creation and all of its life to bring about the end of all evil and suffering for the rest of eternity. Christianity provides us with a two creation model, not a one creation model.
Very good. At this point in the series of recordings, I think it'd be helpful to recommend some resources. Perhaps we can do that. Hugh, you've been talking about at least one of your books and some of your comments there. Maybe you could recommend.
Well, the latter one I was referring to is Why the Universe is the Way It Is, which kind of gives you a context for why God would have 3.8 billion years of diverse life history on the planet in such a way that it would look like, at first appearances, a gradual progression from simple life to more complex. And I think that's an important point, is that, you know, in many respects, we agree with theistic evolutionists and evolutionary creationists on the data and the history of life on planet Earth. It's our interpretation of why the fossil record looks the way it does, why the universe looks the way it does, where we have significant differences. That's a book I would recommend as a place to start to get the big picture, and it's easy to read. But I would argue, Fuzz, we've probably published 10 books over the past 20 years that lay out our biblical creation model and how that contrasts with theistic evolution. More than a theory tries to give you a quick summary, but I've also noted that many theistic evolutionists and evolutionary creationists look at that book as a sum total of our biblical creation model. Actually, it's only a summary. And if people really want the scientific and theological details, they need to read the 10 books that that book was attempting to summarize.
You know, if people are interested in the deficiency of the evidence in favor of the origin of life, the book Origins of Life that Hugh and I wrote together would be a great place to go. My most recent book, Creating Life in the Lab, would be another book that people could refer to. If people want to see the evidence for the design of life, at least at a fundamental level, my book, The Cell's Design, would be a great place to go. There's something also in that book about convergence, which is something we mentioned earlier, at least looking at convergence at a biochemical level. There's a whole host of articles on our website about convergence, looking at it at the organismal level, if people are interested in seeing some support for some of the things that we briefly talked about. We also have a lot of articles about the fossil record on our website as well, and the idea that there is explosive appearances that you see throughout life's history. The book Who Was Adam gives problems with the human evolutionary model and also makes a case for the explosive appearance of human uniqueness.
Well, I know that book is important because I think that's the one place where theistic evolutionists and evolutionary creationists have been most critical of our model as our model for Adam and Eve and humanity. And therefore, I think it's important that people look at Who Is Adam as a way of laying out where our model differs from their model.
And we also, on our website, in articles as well as in podcasts, have responded to new advances that have happened in human origins research, but also have responded to the criticisms that have been leveled against our model since Who Was Adam was published. So if people look at these books plus look at the articles on our website, I think there's a wealth of resources that are available to people for them to begin to appreciate, I think, the depth of the scientific problems with biological evolution and consequently with a position that would say God used evolution exclusively to create.
And theistic evolutionists and evolutionary creationists have published now numerous books on the Genesis creation accounts. And therefore, I think our book, The Genesis Question, the debate book we did with young Earth creationists and framework hypothesis advocates, The Genesis Debate, where you get to see differing views. Many theistic evolutionists would hold to the framework hypothesis, so that'd be a good place to look. A Matter of Days is another place to look. Ken's two books that he's published with us have some excellent critique of the philosophical flaws with a theistic evolution or evolutionary creationist position. So again, we have been very busy over the past 20 years dealing with this specific subject.
Another book that goes very well with the Genesis debate, it offers various views. I like those books, by the way, where you have three views or four views. I think they're very healthy. This one is called Three Views of Creation and Evolution. It's edited by Moreland and Reynolds from Biola University, but very helpful. It has responders, Vern Poitras, John Jefferson Davis, critique the theistic evolutionary view, the old Earth perspective, the young Earth perspective. These books are very helpful for people who are kind of being introduced to the topic, want to know what the best arguments are.
So plenty of reading material. Thank you for listening to this recording. Join us for the next segment. We will take up the topic of common descent. Join us then.